So what I wanted to speak about tonight is about the value of fellowship, whether that's within AA or NA or any 12-step fellowship or outside that, and the necessity of that for sort of ongoing recovery or for really to make recovery a sustainable practice or lifestyle. I just wanted to check with you guys. Do any of you participate in any form of fellowship for your own personal process?
Well, I'll begin. I definitely do. I belong to a group called the Evolutionary Collective. And okay. Its purpose is to create a new paradigm for human relatedness. And so it is very much focused on relationship, on the we space.
Yeah.
So I have that, and then I have several other groups. I head a women's group called World Calling Women, and we meet two times a month and are going on a retreat next month. So I have a book group and a writing group. So I have a number of groups and relationships that are really valuable to me.
Okay, great.
Wow, Victoria, that's impressive. I'd like to learn more about that. I would love to have you share some more about that. Mine is a lot smaller than what Victoria does. Mine is more kind of spiritually based. I'm a Reiki master and a Diksha blessing giver, which is, I have groups that I participate in, but that's about it.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing that. So I think that, I think the talk tonight will be relevant really for anybody that's participating in a group in their own process, but I'll specifically be speaking about why groups or fellowships, in particular fellowships like AA or NA, is so effective for people with addictive disorders. And I think where I want to start basically is trying to explain this type of thing one can explain from many perspectives, obviously. But what I'd like to start from is from what they call a self-psychology perspective, and looking at why fellowships are effective. And in many ways, from this perspective, one can see as why it's actually essential for an addict to be part of some fellowship. So basically, self-psychology is just a branch of psychology, a sort of umbrella term, really, that primarily focuses on the construct of the self as one of the central constructs in understanding psychology and dynamics. So it comes from this sort of psychoanalytic tradition, but instead of focusing on the sort of Freudian drives and all that stuff, they see the self as really the sense and probably one of the most important elements of understanding one's psychological dynamics. And what the self psychologists say is that many addicts have what could be called narcissism, or what some people call archaic narcissism. And basically what narcissistic disorders are in some ways, the root of that lies in having some form of damage in early relationships. Having some, won't necessarily say poor relationships, but there was some sort of dysfunction in early relationships, especially sort of between the age of 1 and 5 or, 2 and 4, that period of development, because that's really the period of development where kids have very powerful narcissistic needs. And, You know, normally we see narcissism as a negative thing. You know, in sort of popular psychology, narcissism is always used in a negative context, like it's a bad thing. But narcissism in itself is not a bad thing. What is a bad thing, if I can say, what could be called archaic narcissism. And archaic narcissism refers to the type of narcissism that, that children display, you know, around the age of 3 or 4 or so. And at the age of 3 or 4, narcissism is a very healthy and developmentally appropriate state of mind to have for a young child. Because of his narcissism, he gets certain needs met, which is essential. What becomes problematic is that adults display narcissism while adults that resembles the type of narcissism that, that a young child displays, which is very self-centered, you know, egocentric. They, you know, anybody that knows children, you know, they want what they want when they want it, and if they don't get it, there's a bit of a tantrum or what could be called narcissistic rage. So be that as it may, so basically what happens is if a child at that narcissistic stage of development doesn't get his needs met, which is basically his narcissistic needs, and we'll talk about the different needs that, that kids have at that stage. What can happen is that these narcissistic needs get carried forward, sometimes, you know, probably mostly unconsciously, but into adult life. And what self-psychologists like Coet and those guys say is that because these needs aren't met at that age, adults with narcissistic issues or archaic narcissism more appropriately will have what's referred to as a very strong object hunger. And what object hunger is a sort of, It's not necessarily a negative thing either, but when it becomes disproportionate, and what an object hunger is sort of a need for narcissistic, there's sort of three types of narcissistic needs that one can have. The one is a sort of mirroring, narcissistic mirroring, where you need people, and things outside of yourself to mirror back to you, that you're okay. The other type of need is what's referred to as sort of idealized need, is where you need to idealize something outside of yourself. Narcissism is where you feel the need to merge with some form of idealized object. And all of those needs, like I said, is entirely appropriate for a young kid. And in normally young kids, the mother will take on the role as the mirroring object. So she'll mirror back to the kid, you know, how great he is, you know, everything he does is like the best in the world. You know, when I speak to my young daughter and she doodles something and I don't even know what it is, you know, I'll say, wow, that's the best picture I've ever seen in my life. You're so great. And what one is doing there is you're mirroring back this narcissistic need, which obviously isn't necessarily the truth, but at that age, that's what a kid needs to hear. He needs to hear that, listen, I'm the best thing that's ever walked on the planet. And in the same way, the father or the mother, but very often the father, provides a type of idealized figure in the child's life where the child looks up to the parent as, you know, the best adult that's ever walked on the planet. You know, kids will refer to their parents or fathers or mothers as Superman or whatever. And that's what they need, is they need to think that their parents are bigger than life, nearly omnipotent at that age. And then they also need to merge with their parents because they think their parents are just so great. Because they are part of their parents, that makes themselves feel good about themselves. So basically when these sort of three narcissistic needs are met, then the child, you know, internalizes a healthy sense of self, which leads to the next developmental phases, etc., which obviously has different needs. And the older the child gets, you know, the narcissistic needs get less and less and less, we develops the capacity to have more of a realistic interaction with the world. You know, so when he's 13, nobody needs to tell him that he's the cleverest, most good-looking and sweetest person that's ever walked on the earth. You can get a more realistic feedback and be okay with that. But you can't tell a two-year-old child that, yeah, you know, your drawings are fairly good, but, you know, you still need to work on that and this and this, and this isn't good and that isn't good. He's only going to experience that as a sense of rejection. He hasn't got the capacity to differentiate between that level of ambiguity. So basically what these guys are saying is that adults that have narcissistic wounding in some way are very prone to substance abuse and older. Sorry, this is some background noise somewhere. I think that's gone. Are you guys still with me and following?
Yep.
Yes, I can hear you okay.
Okay. So what's important for us and what these guys are saying is that very often adults that still struggle from archaic narcissism and didn't have the narcissistic needs as children, pro addiction in later life. You know, and this all sounds very, very theoretical and everything, but virtually every addict that I've ever worked with reports some form of narcissistic injury in his childhood. It's very seldom that I've met somebody that hasn't got some of these issues. So basically what happens as an adult is there's a difficult dynamic that gets set up due to narcissistic injury. The first thing is that the adult is left with a nearly unsatiable appetite for narcissistic feedback, which these guys refer to sort of object hunger. And the problem with that is that nowhere in the real world, in the adult world, can you have these narcissistic needs met at the level that one would expect that, in the same way that a child can have it met. The second problem that these type of people have is that they, in a way, have sort of lost faith in getting their narcissistic needs met from other people, because the original wounding came from their relationships. So they develop a sort of mistrust. I think on somebody's speaker, there's quite a lot of background noise that's quite audible. That's gone.
Guy, would it help? I'll try putting mine on mute and see if that helps.
Okay. Thanks for that. So basically what the predicament that these people find themselves in as adults is that they've got an incredible strong need for relationships. They've got an incredible strong need for people to tell them that they're okay, etc., for basically narcissistic mirroring, but at the same time, they're mistrustful of relationships. And this nearly puts them in a double bind. And in many ways, they're ashamed of their sort of excessive need for this type of intimacy and this type of connection. And then what happens is if people with that type of issues encounter substances, the substance can provide narcissistic needs in quite a dramatic fashion. In fact, all of those types of narcissistic needs can be met by using drugs. And very quickly the person realizes, consciously or unconsciously, is that, you know, this sort of emptiness, this hole in the soul that addicts often talk about, which can be described as sort of narcissistic need or wounding, can be very easily and very quickly fulfilled through some up to the other allure of substances is that it's not another person that you become dependent on. because they have a fear of becoming dependent on people, because it's people that created this injury in the first place. So in a way, a drug, alcohol or drug, when you're addictive behavior, becomes the perfect alternative for their narcissistic needs, because they have all these needs met, and it's also something that they can control. You know, they can just go and buy it or store it, whatever. And what the self-psychologists say is that's one of the reasons why people with narcissistic injury are so prone to addiction in later life. Now, what all of this is relevant to our conversation tonight, maybe just before I go on, is there anything anybody wants to ask, or is everything clear until now before I explain the role of...
I have a question, Guy, and it's a two-part question. Can you give several examples of what you're calling a narcissistic injury, one, and two, would you feel that this is a product of the addict condition or just like a human condition? I feel like when you say that you've never counseled an addict that hasn't had a narcissistic injury or narcissistic issue in early childhood, I feel like maybe a lot of people have, but they didn't become addicted. And I guess the second part of my question is, what do you feel? I mean, is this something that others just get over, or how does a narcissistic injury come out in healthy ways in life, you know, like that don't lead to addiction? Or in other words, like, I just think a lot of the traits that addicts say that they grew up with, not feeling like they belong, not feeling a part of, not feeling like a prisoner in their own skin, not fully relating to life, I feel like a lot of times that's just a part of the human condition. Many people feel that way growing up. Some become addicts and some don't. My question is, what is the ticking bomb there? Or how do regular, quote-unquote, non-addicts, you know, regular people deal with such injury that caused an addict to want to use drugs and not deal with it? Is my question clear? I feel like it was a little muffled.
Yeah, I think it's very clear. I think it's a very important question. I mean, also to make it clear that all of these things are on a continuum. You know, there is somebody, you know, on the one side there'd be no narcissistic wounding, and on the other side there'd be extreme narcissistic. And most people find themselves somewhere in this continuum. And even if you're not, a lot of people have some degree of narcissistic wounding. Just the way our culture is set up. Sorry, there's still a lot of... Is it from your side?
Sounds like someone's typing.
Yeah. Because I can't hear myself.
So it sounds like it's just a problem with the connection that comes up every little bit.
So, you know, pretty much we grow up to be narcissistically oriented, and I think that's why addiction is so rife in our culture, because we don't get suffer narcissistic wounding due to whatever reason. And I think that's one of the big etiological factors in the modern society that has given rise to big drug epidemic we have. But also a lot of people with narcissistic disorders won't become addicted as well. They'll find other ways to have that narcissistic needs met that can be seen as socially acceptable. You know, workaholism or extreme athletics or overly religious or whatever, you know. So there's many other ways for people like that to function or get these needs met, not necessarily due to substance abuse, as far as I'm concerned. Does that answer the question?
Yes, but the first part, can you cite some examples of narcissistic issues or injury in early childhood?
Yeah, so let's say for instance a child grows up in a house where there are let's say the rules are too strict or there's a lot of criticisms or anything, then basically let's look at the one aspect of narcissism where one needs to be mirrored. So for whatever reason, you know, it might be realistic or unrealistic, but for whatever reason, the child feels that his parents or caregivers or whoever's around him doesn't mirror back to him, which he perceives as his greatness and nearly omnipotence in the world, you will experience that as a narcissistic wounding. So, you know, let's say something like a child makes a drawing, you tell the child, oh, that's a really crap drawing, then the child is going to wound. Feels that his, you know, talents aren't, or his being isn't being appreciated, that's going to leave him feeling like there's something wrong with him. And very often, it's not something that parents do directly. I mean, we'll all do that to our kids to some extent. It's very often a consequence of parents fighting and divorce and broken families and issues between the parents. And the child will internalize that as, listen here, there's something wrong with me. And what one needs to understand is that, you know, children at that age have an excessive need to be mirrored. You know, have an excessive need to look up to their parents or caregivers and think that they are the best thing in the world. You know, so it's not a realistic, you know, so if you treat the child like an adult at that age, it will lead to narcissistic wounding. You know, you need to treat the child developmentally appropriate, which one needs to understand that he isn't at a narcissistic age, he's got very, very specific needs that need to be met, which are the needs for grandiosity. He needs to feel like he's the center of the universe. And obviously, as the child gets older, you know, those needs need to be, in a way, counteracted, because then he's just going to grow up with an inflated sense of self. But it's quite a difficult thing to navigate with children, because you need to discipline children, you need to contain children. But at the same time, you need to also have these, what could be considered fairly unrealistic, you know, sort of unrealistic logical needs that they have at that point. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
So basically, turning to fellowships, why some people feel that AA, you know, is so effective, there's sometimes a joke, you know, in fellowships that it's not NA, it's Narcissist Anonymous. I think it's very true. In a way, AA and fellowships are set up for people to have these narcissistic needs met. In an unrealistic fashion, but in a fashion that fellowships or organizations provide people with these type of narcissistic needs with adults. What some people believe is that out of these three narcissistic needs that adults have with narcissistic disorders, if we could idealize the mirror hungry and the merger pro needs, firstly, 12-step fellowships provide addicts when they enter with a sort of idealized other, with something that's far bigger than themselves that they can idealize and look up to, i.e. the 12-step program, fellowship, sponsors, etc. It's something that you can idealize. And by having this idealized other in your life, that satisfies your. And at the same time, participate in the fellowship is practical and attainable. You know, it's not an idolized other that's completely removed from the world. It's something that's very real and very close to you. And then as far as the mirroring goes, You know, you join a fellowship, which there's a, I think there's a saying that, you know, somebody went to his first AA meeting and, you know, he told them what a horrible person he was and what he's done to his family and, you know, what he's done to his life. And at the end of the meeting, people gave him their phone numbers, you know, like, hey, welcome, call me. And I mean, in most places in the world, if you go out and tell people that type of story, everyone's going to run a mile. But in places like NOAA, people, you know, completely accept you for that. So in that way, you know, you get a mirroring need met that in most places in the adult world, you won't really get mirroring for that type of, not that somebody's mirror, you know, congratulating on that, you on that behavior, but you accept it for who you are when you join that type of fellowships and you speak in meetings, you get mirrored back, people tell you you're doing good and all that type of stuff. And that basically meets the mirroring needs that, that one has. And, people refer to NAA as like the sort of good enough mother, or transitional object that people have in the same way that kids have a transitional object like a teddy bear, something that guides them until they can internalize these relationships inside of themselves. AA functions like the sort of other transitional object so people can internalize the principles of the program inside of themselves.
Guy, it's Victoria, and the interference is getting so bad I can hardly hear you. It's like every other word. I wonder if we called back in again, if that would...
I think we should try that. Yeah.
Let's try that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay.
Yep.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
That seems much better.
It does seem better. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I thought it was only on my side that it sounded so bad.
No.
Okay. Well, is everyone on? Should I continue?
Is Julie on?
Yeah, I'm just on mute.
Okay.
Okay. Great.
Okay. Just to finish off on that line of thought. So, you know, so this sounds very overly technical in some ways, but in a nutshell, what it just points out is that fellowships like AA and NA provides the ideal environment where people with these early issues can find an environment where what can in many ways be considered a sort of unrealistic need that they still carry into adulthood, when these needs can actually be satisfied until a lot of the stuff is internalized. And once these needs are sort of satisfied in an adult, then one can see that basically the narcissistic wounding gets less and less and less, until the individual can start having a realistic expectation of people, a realistic sense of self, and a realistic interaction with the world. So in many ways, if one looks at it from this perspective, if somebody with that early childhood issues, even if he cleans up from his drug of choice, etc., you know, these underlying narcissistic issues aren't addressed, the person is going to continue with this sort of really sense of emptiness or sense of not, you know, just not getting enough out of other people or other things, but, you know, continue into his life. And that feeling will continue, and very likely his behavior will continue in a way that is continuously looking for something to fill these gaps. And even if it gives up drugs for that matter, in many ways that's what can be seen as cross-addicting, or what's considered the dry drunk syndrome in NOAA, that a person still has this, has these issues and will continuously be seeking other ways to have these needs gratified, which in many ways, the unfortunate thing is that there's virtually no place in the world where, you know, extreme narcissistic needs can be met in any form of healthy way, in society, which is going to leave the person, you know, either disappointed with things or with people, or basically develop some form of fantasy world where in his fantasy he can have these needs met. But either way, it's going to leave the individual with serious issues that is unresolved. And maybe just one thing to add to that, another perspective from a self-psychology perspective as well that I touched upon that ties in with this is what can be called a sort of fantasy-based model. And what these guys are saying is that when people with these narcissistic needs as children with narcissistic needs that aren't being met, as they develop into adults, they develop this fantasy life that in a way compensates for this uncohesive sense of self or this fragmented sense of self or the sense of self that you just feel not good enough or too small or, you know, whatever you experience it phenomenologically. And when adults encounter substances or drugs in their adult life, what the drug then does is it creates a type of sort of hypnoid altered state where these underlying fantasies can get activated. So let's say, for instance, the cocaine addict that as a kid felt, you know, overly intimidated by his father and made to feel quite weak and small, when he encounters crack or cocaine or methamphetamine as an adult, all of a sudden you'll be flooded with feelings of power, unlimited control, etc., which correlates with a fantasy that he developed as a child to overcompensate for these inadequacies. And what these guys point out in many ways is not just the addiction to the substance, it's primarily the addiction to the fantasy that substances provide for people. And the fantasy is so powerful that people virtually get lost in this fantasy. And these guys wrote a book called, Ullman and Paul wrote a book called Narcissus in Wonderland, which I think was a great title just to sort of summarize the state. Because literally the narcissistic person gets lost in his own wonderland, which is really this fantasy, this overcompensating fantasy that he's developed in his life, and the substances activate this fantasy. So the addictive individual has got two choices. Either he can live in this fantasy where he's, you know, king of the universe and everything is under his control and he feels great, or he can go back into his normal state, which is a state of deficiency, a state of emptiness, a state of not feeling good enough. And in many ways, that's why addicts will continue to pursue their addictive behavior, not because but that it provides an escape from their normal state. And there's such a difference between the fantasy state and their normal state that, in sort of common sense, it would actually make sense that somebody would rather inhabit that fantasy state where they actually feel good about themselves rather than inhabit the state where you feel crap about yourself all the time, even though it might be unconscious. So for people to get better in recovery, a lot of that fantasy stuff needs to be worked through, etc., and the person needs to develop a realistic sense of self. And pretty much, you know, better finish off as well, so to give you guys time to talk as well. But in closing, one can say the only thing that's going to repair this addiction to this fantasy, and is going to repair this unrealistic sort of narcissistic self that people often have, is realistic and healthy interactions with other human beings. Narcissistic issues cannot be resolved in isolation through study or even meditation or diet or anything like that. Attachment disorder, which pretty much what this stuff is, it can only be repaired through new and healthy attachment. And one of the benefits of fellowships like AA and NA is that there's enough people in there to have that met. You know, it's not like you're going to fellowship with only two people, you know, and those two people might have issues themselves and they're going to disappoint you and et cetera. But there's more than enough people within AA that between all these people, somewhere along the line, you're going to find people that you connect with. The fellowship itself won't reject you. The 12 steps won't reject you. And periods of time, these stuff can slowly be repaired, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, takes a good couple of years, if not decade or two, you know, who knows. But I've certainly seen people within fellowships heal this attachment stuff pretty rapidly, that it becomes manageable and doesn't dominate their lives, because otherwise it continues to pretty much dominate their life. So I'm going to end there. I mean, this is obviously a very limited and non-integral perspective, because it's a very fragmented perspective of why AA works, but that was the whole point of the talk, is just to look at it from one specific lens. It's certainly not the only answer or the answer to everything, but I think a pretty useful perspective to include within the integral lens of this whole thing. So let me end there. So is there anything anybody wants to add to that? Or ask or critique?
Well, this is Victoria, and the question that arises for me is whether the 12-step group, AANA, is enough to work through these deeper childhood issues. Or, this is too simplistic, but I'll say it anyway, can people almost become addicted to the mirroring or the reinforcement that they receive from other people in the 12-step group?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. I might go as far as to say that initially they have to become addicted to it. As bizarre as that might sound, their initial relationship with NA and AA would, in, I suppose, normal, would be considered unhealthy. But that's exactly what they need. You know, any form of narcissistic attachment in the beginning is going to be, you know, in a way unrealistic and unhealthy. But, and when I say unhealthy, I'm comparing it to other, you know, let's call it normal attachment, but that is exactly what the person needs. And I think if these needs are met initially, and as the person develops in his recovery, his sort of unrealistic or unhealthy attachment to AA and or NA will become less and less, to a point where he can actually function in the world and have these needs met in a healthy way. And I think that's the aim of this, in a way, is to provide a sort of nearly, I won't say unrealistic, but a sort of slightly abnormal container initially, so that the person develops the skill to actually have these needs met in the outside world. But I think if you know, clean a long time or 20 years clean and you're still using NOAA for the same reasons that somebody would use it with a month's clean, then I would say, yes, then it becomes unhealthy. And I think people can maybe get stuck in that, where they stay in this sort of slightly narcissistic universe where these, you know, you drink all the time, regardless of what you do. You know, you're an addict, and as long as you speak in meetings, everyone's going to clap for you, etc. So I think there's a developmental perspective on this. For some stages, it's great, but maybe for other stages, it can become maybe even toxic or not great.
Thank you. That's good. So in integral recovery, are there other ways outside of just the 12-step groups to create the community that meets some of these needs?
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting question as well. I mean, AA or NA doesn't have the exclusive, you know, right to have these needs met for anybody. So I think any fellowship, whether it's NA or AA, that has the same level of infrastructure as NA or AA has, can function as a similar milieu or similar experience for people. And I also think some people with that hasn't got that extreme narcissistic issues can, you know, very often you have these needs met through more normal relationships, you know, just like families or romantic relationships or friends. And also, you know, when somebody's in a 12-step fellowship, you know, that's not his only relationships. He still has relationships with his friends or family or romantic partners, which needs to function in parallel with 12-step fellowships. 12-step fellowships provide a specifically unique container for these type of things. I think what I've experienced is that, you know, people that have really been in addiction for a long time and, you know, struggle with these type of issues, it'd be very difficult for them to have these needs met from this particular context in any sort of normal fellowship. You know, let's say just by attending a meditation, just having friends at his meditation center or something, which for many people would be fine, you know, to provide a sense of connection or something. So for many people in recovery, they could find connection through other fellowships and that will work for them. But I think there's also a certain portion of people in recovery that would need the big guns like NA or AA. So it's not a blanket rule. But for people that really struggle with this, you know, it's either NA or AA or something that's on par of NA or AA when it comes to this. And if they don't get that, the chance of them, you know, repairing this type of stuff, unless they're doing, you know, therapy the whole week and five times a week or something, a really intense program, it's unlikely that they're gonna, you know, have these needs met at any reasonable pace anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously then one speaking about a certain part of the population, maybe a more extreme part of it.
Well, and I can see how therapy would provide some of the mirroring anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, I think an intensive therapy, especially stuff like psychoanalysis, therapy, possibly do something very similar, because, you know, there one is also in a very intense environment where these type of needs are met consistently, you know, 3-4 times a week. So like I say, it's not just NA or AA, but there has to be a pretty serious and intensive process where these type of stuff can happen in the individual. And in fact, mentioning therapy, what this Uman and Paul guys say is that the therapist needs to become the replacement drug for the addict, which is another way of saying is that the euphoria that the addict used to feel by his drives, and the fantasy that that state created needs to be recreated in therapy. So when the addict goes to see the therapist, he needs to re-enter and get my state and feels all cared for, all warm, all nourished, etc. in that therapeutic hour or whatever hours it is, which obviously, you know, is a sort of unrealistic state to go into in anywhere else in the world, but a therapeutic environment will actually allow somebody to go into that state. And that ties quite closely with altered states of consciousness. So what they suggest is that the individual needs to replace the altered state of consciousness of the drug with the altered state of consciousness that a therapeutic process provides. And I think that's why NOAA provides, is going to meetings and all that stuff, provides an altered state that people can enter into within that specific environment. And once they develop, you know, which is certainly a healthier altered state than the previous altered state, and eventually, you know, I think they can function in the world where they don't need to go into an altered state of consciousness just to have the needs met. It can be met in a more realistic day-to-day way. Any other comments on that, perhaps?
Well, I'm talking a lot, but I'm also thinking about the work of Brené Brown on shame and her conversation about how narcissism is very shame-based, sure, or shame-based, and it is that sense of unworthiness. And I see how all of this ties so beautifully together. If you've had no mirror that mirrors your worthiness, then there is that hole inside that is a shame hole that needs to be filled in order for a person to recover.
Absolutely. I mean, the phenomenological experience of narcissistic wounding is the shame that he speaks about. So the state of narcissism is just a shame-based state. Totally. And also, you know, as with the narcissism and the shame, is also what one must understand about narcissism is that it's very often seen as excessive self-love, but that's a misinterpretation of narcissism. You know, narcissism comes from the myth of Narcissus that can love with his own reflection in the mirror and then, you know, basically starve to death because he couldn't stop looking at himself. And that's what one must understand is that the narcissist is in love his false sense of self or his reflection, you know, the fantasy that he has created for himself. And that is why, looking at the fantasy model, that's why the drug is so addictive, is because his entire sense of self is derived from his reflection, his fantasy. And the drug, you know, amplifies this fantasy to such an extent that it's very difficult for the narcissist to give up this amazing fantasy, because the reality is that if you take the fantasy away, if you take the reflection away, there's nothing else. You know, the narcissist hasn't learned how to reflect back to himself. He can only, you know, be reflected to or see a reflection on the outside. And, you know, if you're in a healthy environment where people actually start reflecting realistic stuff back to you, you develop the capacity then to reflect back to yourself, which then recover out of the shame-based core, because you develop the internal resources to start feeling good about yourself. But as long as you're a shame-based core, then all your sense of self or all your worthiness will have to come from the outside. And obviously in the adult world, you know, people don't walk around congratulating you the whole day. So you have to create a sort of strange world to yourself where your reflection can be held up all the time. And you know, as the conversation led to, that's why AA and NA and fellowships like that work, is because it is an, you know, a different world where these things can actually be met, but in a loving way, not in a destructive, negative, or narcissistic way.
Guy, do these types of narcissistic traumas and injury that cause people to develop object relations only happen in childhood or in early childhood, or can they happen, let's say, in adolescence or even as adults?
Well, that's an interesting question, because we, you know, as far as I understand, we always have narcissistic needs. So at any stage of development, you know, one's narcissistic needs can be sort of injured, or one's sense of self can be injured. But there's a particular stage in development which can be considered the sort of narcissistic stages of development, which, you know, say from, I think, roughly between 1 and 4, where one is particularly prone to narcissistic. The type of wounding one has, I wouldn't necessarily say would be narcissistic wounding. That could be a more a wounding to the sense of self, you know, all sorts of trauma. It's a link, so it's difficult to separate them from each other. But it's a different type of trauma that happens as an adult than the type of trauma that happens to a child when he's in the narcissistic periods of development. The trauma that happens at that age leaves the sense of self much more damaged, if I can make it sound dramatic, than similar type of damage would at a later age. So it's a very vulnerable period of one's development, and that's why very often people with addictive disorder have specifically damaged at that time. Where if you had damaged when you were older, it might not have such a hectic effect on your life as an adult. And also the problem is with that type of narcissistic stuff, it's mostly pre-verbal. So people don't really have memory of it. It's not something you can talk away in therapy. It's just a vague feeling that you're left with.
Right.
Okay, I think we got to 8 o'clock. Any final comments or anything anybody wants to add before we finish?
Well, I find this to be really fascinating.
So do I.
Yeah, this has been very, very helpful to get this perspective.
Yeah. And I just want to add as well, this stuff sounds all very dramatic and severe, but you know, these are technical terms we give this stuff just to try and make sense of it. But as Hamlet pointed out in the beginning, you know, it's also part of the human condition. You know, we all develop narcissistic wounding at that age. You know, it's just part of life as well. But like with everything, when something goes to the extreme, that's where it becomes really problematic. And what we're talking about in this case here is the more extreme versions of that. But in many ways, it's very much the human condition as well. And obviously, some societies it can happen more just because of the way the society is structured. And in some societies, it might happen less. So I'm also not trying to blame the parents, you know, either. Sometimes it's just inevitable. Okay, well, let's end it to that. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for your participation and interest. And I hope it was useful in some way.
It was very useful. Thank you, Guy.
Okay.
Thank you, Guy.
Right.
Well done. Thanks, Guy.
Okay, we'll speak soon. Thanks.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, okay, bye.